From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This year, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcasts from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners, you. If you've made a donation this week, let me tell you how important that is to us and how thankful we are for that gift. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. With very few exceptions, we always try to include a diversity of topics on State of Belief Radio every week. Almost always, there's more that we want to cover than the available time allows. But ever so often, a story is so compelling that we devote the full hour to looking at it, usually from a couple of different angles. That's what we're going to do this week, but with a twist. We'll be analyzing a relatively new, mostly unnoticed, truly global ambition of the American political religious right, with experts from both the sending and the receiving ends of a frightening attempt to achieve cultural dominance. It's nothing short of an attempt at theocratic cultural imperialism, building alliances around one controversial initiative that opens doors to many others. And that initiative is homeschooling. For years, political religious right activists in the U.S. have schemed to undermine public education by siphoning off funds in the form of private vouchers, which their followers could use to fund their children's education at religiously oriented schools. The next step was demanding that untrained, unsupervised homeschooling also qualify for these taxpayer funds. We are a long way from Little House on the Prairie style learning at mother's knee. No, this is an industrial scale assault on the premise of shared knowledge, shared values, and shared responsibility for all of our kids. It's a petri dish for growing a culture of alternate facts, suspicion of science and governmental authority, a safe breeding ground for anti-LGBTQI plus propaganda, a woman's place is in the home, sexism, and a network of loyalties barely visible to those of us who do not participate in this movement and do not share its values. Think I'm overstating the threat? Well, then why are the powerful right-wing authoritarians who have so successfully promoted homeschooling as something bordering on a fundamental religious liberty issue so relentlessly funding the promotion of the concept and all of its associated baggage to countries all over the world? While truly unraveling this vast network would take more time than we have here today, my primary goal is to credibly demonstrate that these movements overseas are not organic grassroots attempts to improve the well-being of children, but a concerted effort to seize control of compliant, complicit layers of society under the guise of nationalistic religious values. We'll try to do this with the help of two expert researchers on the subject, Dr. Christina Stukel at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, whose focus on new alliances between nationalistic and religious conservatives in Orthodox-majority countries led to the unexpected discovery of widespread organizing around American-style homeschooling culture. And Ryan Stoller, a California-based theologian and writer who has just published an alarming report headlined, "How Homeschoolers Plan to Take Over the World." So, let's start there. Since both scholars contend that ground zero of this audacious attempt is right here at home. Ryan Stoller is a child liberation theologian and brings his own experiences of having been homeschooled to his work in advocacy for children in educational and religious contexts. Ryan, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Your report is rich in detail, and we will link to it from stateofbelief.com. But in the context of a conversation that of necessity has to be more limited in scope, start, please, with an introduction to who the homeschoolers you're referring to are.
Yeah. I mean, the homeschooling movement is large and diverse. When it first started out in the 60s, it was something that was started by more liberal and progressive people. You have people like John Holt and Pat Ferenga. They started the Growth Without Schooling magazine, and that really caused homeschooling to explode in the 60s. And then starting in the 70s, though, when the Supreme Court, you know, handed down the court cases on desegregation and taking official public prayer out of schools, you had conservative Christians taking their kids out of public school and then either putting them in private school or homeschooling them. And that is what really caused the homeschooling movement to become commandeered, really, by conservative evangelicals. And those are the people that are the focus of my expose. And they're definitely the people that are driving the public policy the most when it comes to homeschooling. The most significant leaders of the homeschooling movement are from the religious right. They're far-right extremists, and they see homeschooling not as a, you know, just an alternative educational practice, like so many homeschoolers do see it as, but rather as a tool for social and political power.
Ryan, how has GHEX managed to stay virtually unknown for an entire decade?
Yeah, so the Global Home Education Exchange, which I'll refer to as GHEX for short, that is an organization that was founded by conservative evangelical leaders in the U.S. homeschooling movement, primarily people who are associated with HSLDA, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. That's the largest and most powerful homeschool lobby in the United States, and I'd say also the world, specifically because they have decided to expand their advocacy from the United States internationally. And that's why they founded GHEX. Specifically to export homeschooling around the globe and expand their influence, really. For decades, the religious right has been interested in dominionism and taking back the United States for God's glory. And that's, you know, a core aspect of Christian nationalism. But what we're seeing now is that that nationalism is going global, really. So we now have to deal with not just Christian nationalists, but Christian globalists. And GHEX is a key part of that.
I can't understand how they have stayed so unknown by much of the nation.
Yeah, I think that that's a problem that's not unique just to GHEX. That's a problem that's specific to homeschooling. And I mean, really, honestly, a lot of evangelical problems. It seems like, you know, liberals and moderates tend to not really take them seriously. And I mean, I've been involved with homeschool advocacy now for about a decade, and myself and other homeschool alumni have founded multiple organizations to try to bring attention to this issue and raise awareness and try to change public policy. And it is such an uphill battle, not just trying to counter, you know, the religious right homeschoolers, but just trying to get people to pay attention. Yeah. People think that these, you know, homeschooling communities and subcultures are just extreme. They're on the fringe. And yet we've seen over the last 4 years, you know, especially with Trump in power, that they have moved from the fringe to the mainstream. And people are starting to wake up to that fact. And I think that's why we're starting to see a little bit more attention paid to it. Like the article written by Promoser and Schokel, which was an excellent, excellent piece and groundbreaking. So hopefully we'll start to see more attention paid to this. Yeah. But it's definitely going to be a challenge.
Are you surprised by the expanding of this?
I am surprised by it. I was aware that the religious right has been exporting their culture wars overseas for several years now, especially with the World Congress of Families. If you're not familiar with the World Congress of Families, that is an international organization, much like the Moral Majority, and they're just trying to unite social and political conservatives around the world, just like GHEX is doing, but on a larger and broader scale regarding all sorts of conservative issues like opposing same-sex marriage, trying to criminalize LGBTQIA behavior, and trying to ban abortion. So I was aware that there was that, but I had not realized exactly how successful they had been until I had read that article by Promoser and Schokel. And I mean, it's honestly terrifying for me. Yeah. You know, I've spent 10 years trying to fight against the influences of these more extreme religious right communities. And I saw them get closer to power than they ever had before with Trump in office. He gave them unprecedented access to the halls of power. And, you know, we got Biden, and that gives us this small sense of relief and reprieve. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the religious right is not stopping. Mm-hmm. And they are so organized. And that's what a lot of people don't understand about the religious right, is that organization is their superpower, and they know how to unite people across the board in the conservative movement. You know, they can bring together evangelicals, you know, conservative evangelicals, conservative Catholics. They're bringing the conservative Russian Orthodox churches on board. So it's definitely scary to see people that are this good at organization expanding their influence around the world. And I've seen what they can do with that organization. So it's definitely very terrifying, honestly.
You write about how some of the most powerful nationalist Christian supremacist names are involved in the movement as we now know it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have, you know, Michael Ferris, who was the founder of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, and he founded Patrick Henry College, which is a college for homeschoolers. You know, I mentioned it this in my article that, you know, Ferris was very much influenced by Rush Dooney and Christian Reconstructionism, and he believed in creating a parallel society for homeschool kids so that they would not be influenced by worldly, you know, ungodly ideas or philosophies or practices. And so he created a college so that homeschoolers would stay within the fold all the way from kindergarten through college graduation before they're ready to step into the world. And at that point, they're supposed to leave the parallel society and try to take, you know, the United States back for God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ferris has made so many friends and allies through the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And he's now the president of the Alliance Defense Fund, ADF, which is one of the most powerful religious right lobbying groups here in the United States. And they've been involved now internationally as well. They have been trying to establish homeschooling as a human right in European human rights courts. And they've also been responsible for some of the, you know, anti-gay laws in Russia, in Uganda. They've supported the sterilization, the forced sterilization of trans people. So these people are, they're very committed to what they're doing, and they're very good at it. And the Christian nationalism aspect is so interesting because for decades, they've been saying that they need to bring the United States back to its Christian roots. And the United States has been ordained by God to be, you know, the protector of the world. And they didn't want the United States to be subjected to any international treaties because of sovereignty. But now they've changed their focus and they're going global. And it's really interesting to see people who are Christian nationalists now become Christian globalists. Mm-hmm. And that is a change that is very significant. I don't think a lot of people are paying attention to that or starting to change their language, because when we think of nationalism, of course, we're thinking about, you know, our country or, you know, anyone, any given country that the person is from. And there's this, you know, isolationist aspect to that mentality. But now they've decided that they're going to go global. Yeah. And they want each country to be shaped just like how they want the United States to be shaped. Yeah. So their goals and targets have expanded drastically.
And we're discussing his research into this powerful authoritarian network. How did you first become aware of the international ambitions that these people have?
I first became aware of it when I was writing an article on Alan Carlson, who is the founder of the World Congress of Families. And Carlson gave a lecture at Patrick Henry College, the homeschool college founded by Michael Ferris. And in that lecture that he gave, he talked a lot about his work with the World Congress of Families. And I started looking into that and noticing that the fingerprints of homeschool leaders were all over that. Carlson himself is a homeschool apologist. He's a really good friend with Mike Ferris. And really the groups of people that make up the World Congress of Families and then the groups of people that make up GHEX, there's a lot of overlap between them. Mm-hmm. So once you start looking into any of these international organizations, you'll start to see that the homeschoolers' fingerprints are all over them. Even if they don't seem to have anything to do with homeschooling, the worlds there have become so intertwined now, it's hard to distinguish them.
Ryan, why are they really doing this?
I think it's power, and I think that they are going on the offensive. So the Homeschool Legal Defense Association has now for years, they've been opposed to the United States ratifying United Nations treaties. HSLDA has successfully shot down the ratification of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, the Convention Against Violence Against Women. We haven't ratified any of those treaties, and that's specifically because of HSLDA. They believe that once the United States submits to international treaties, that that will take away the rights of parents to do what they want with their children. And so they're going on the offensive and trying to change basically those treaties themselves, the language of international law, so that they not only have secured the rights of parents in the United States, but also the rights of parents internationally, so that that will not eventually be a threat to the rights of parents in the United States. So I think that what they're really going for is the most power that they possibly can get a hold of. And I don't say that, you know, I think it's negative, of course, but I'm not, that's just a, I'd say just a description of what they're going for is power.
Is it going too far to call this cultural imperialism?
I don't think so at all. I think that's exactly what it is. I think that we're seeing the religious right trying to remake the entire world in their image, which is absolutely cultural imperialism. I mean, to some really significant extent, I mean, we could even call it colonialism, because we're trying to make everyone, you know, line up with our ideals of white supremacy and Christian supremacy instead of learning how to live in a pluralistic world. And I think that that's probably one of the biggest issues here is that the religious right is opposed to pluralism and democracy. And we will not be able to successfully fight against them or successfully learn who they are unless we understand that the movement by and large is anti-pluralist and anti-democratic. Yeah. So it can't just be reasoned with. We have to make sure that we are protecting all people's rights, all marginalized groups' rights. Otherwise, if we just let the religious right do what they want, then we're going to see a lot of people's rights taken away.
Yeah. You write about the profoundly racist aspects of early modern homeschooling movements in the United States. What are the real dangers and how close are these people to achieving their desired goals?
I think that they are getting pretty close, but they've had some setbacks. You know, Trump not being reelected for a second term, that definitely set them back. But there's always the possibility that he'll run again, of course. And I'd say that, I mean, the fact that they've gone international and been so successful doing so, I think that's going to be really the key challenge is catching up to them. Because as we talked about earlier, I mean, they've, GHEX has had a whole decade to do their work and no one has known about it. I mean, I didn't even know about it. And I've been studying homeschooling regularly for the last 10 years, in addition to growing up in that world. And that was news to me. So if that's news to me, it's going to be news to a lot of other people. And I think that that international threat is probably the biggest challenge that we have. I think that the most dangerous ambitions, I mean, is their desire for power at all costs. The homeschooling movement has created so much collateral damage, and they don't care about that. I mean, the thousands of homeschool kids who have been abused and neglected, you know, they call them not real homeschoolers or figure out some way to say that they don't count. There have been, you know, so many of the domestic terrorists that we've seen over the last three decades have been homeschool alumni. And none of these problems that keep coming up that should be red flags, that should be telling us, hey, we need to change how we're doing homeschooling. We need to change the culture. We need to think about children in healthier ways. Like, none of that matters, because their ambitions are for power and they're not going to let anything stop them. And that's, you know, they need to realize that their pursuits are having real harm and causing real damage for children and adults. And honestly, I think, I don't know what's going to get them to come to that realization. That's the biggest challenge for me personally, is so many homeschoolers just don't want to listen. You try to talk about these issues, they put their fingers in their ears and say, nah, nah, nah. And that's because they're so focused on those that ambition of making sure that they have the power that they want.
You had an experience as a homeschooled young person. How does that inform you right now as you look at how we deal with a potentially insular, authoritarian, divisive, and arbitrary way being done with these kids? What comes from you inside by experience?
That is an excellent question. I think that my own experience helps me to see all of the ideologies and practices in a very personal way. I've seen how the homeschooling world and culture has hurt my friends. I've seen how it has hurt myself. And that's anything from self-injury to mental illness to suicide to, you know, child abuse. And I've seen so many of those young people become adults who are struggling, and it just breaks my heart, because I know that homeschooling can be good. I didn't have a perfect experience, but I had a generally positive experience being homeschooled. My parents did a decent job of educating me. And so it just makes me so angry to see that this thing, homeschooling, that could be so wonderful and so uplifting for children, if it was just a children's first movement, it's just being used to destroy future generations. And that's such a shame, because it should be used as something to protect and uplift instead.
Ryan Stoller is a child liberation theologian and a longtime activist on behalf of young people in educational and religious contexts. His website is rich in persuasive material on the proliferating homeschooling movement as an international cultural, economic, and authoritarian threat. That website is www.rlstollar.com and is where you'll find the just published report entitled "How Homeschoolers Plan to Take Over the World." Ryan, thank you so much for bringing your expertise and your empathy to us today, and for taking time to talk with us and our listeners on State of Belief.
You are very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Coming right up, we'll look at the other end of the homeschooling export business with Dr. Christina Stokel in Innsbruck, Austria. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows. All of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. We're focusing the entire hour this week on the powerful and remarkably secretive efforts to bring American-style politicized homeschooling ideology and practice to nations across the globe. My next guest was a presenter at a recent online conference focusing on religion as a driving force in what is being called anti-genderism in various parts of the world. Dr. Christina Stokel spoke about the unexpected places she keeps finding U.S.-crafted and U.S.-funded homeschooling movements in Europe, Russia, and beyond. And it was this presentation that initially prompted us to focus on this phenomenon, and in particular, on the incessant denial most Americans and others seem to be in when it comes to the origins of this anything but grassroots movement. We reached her in Innsbruck, Austria. Christina, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your field of study is really pretty far removed from the topic of homeschooling, especially of American origin. How did you first engage with this movement?
It is true that I did not expect to end up doing research on homeschooling. I'm a sociologist of religion, and my area of expertise is Russian Orthodoxy. And I was doing a research project on the discourse on human rights inside the Russian Orthodox Church. And at one point during that research, I came across organizations that engage on behalf of pro-family issues in the language of human rights. And this in itself was interesting because the Russian Orthodox Church does not usually use a modern language to address social ethics. Russian Orthodoxy generally, theologically, is not prepared well, let's say, to address issues of social ethics. And as I'm a sociologist, we also did fieldwork. And we attended a pro-family congress in the city of Tbilisi in Georgia. And there were participants from the United States, the International Organization of Family, Alliance Defending Freedom, the World Congress of Families, and participants from Russia. And one of the topics that was discussed there was homeschooling. And the American guests presented the benefits of homeschooling, and they also presented the benefits of homeschooling curricula to their East European and Russian hosts. And so this is when I realized that that's an interesting topic we should follow up on.
So what were the first signs for you that this was not the innocent grassroots initiative it pretends to be?
Well, first of all, I realized that this is very much against, it's a very new phenomenon in Europe because unlike in Europe, we are accustomed to having confessional private schools. Catholic private schools or Protestant private schools, they are very common. But homeschooling for religious reasons is actually very uncommon. And it's even something that goes against the wishes of most of the official churches. So the Catholic Church in many countries, they're happy with their right to have publicly recognized private schools. They also get tax money for running them. Homeschooling is a very different vision of the role of religion in the public sphere, because it's a vision of religion that sort of goes into a fortress, and that fortress is called family. So this is, I think, one aspect that I thought was noteworthy. And the second is, of course, the vision of family that is constructed around the idea of homeschooling, mm-hmm. namely the family as a fortress, the family as a place where the state does not rule into. And this then extends to other questions, to children's rights, issues of domestic violence, issues of taxation of families, split taxation, shared taxation between spouses. So a lot of questions connect to family, and homeschooling is one access to the topic.
This is particularly noteworthy in Orthodox Christian circles, your area of expertise, because, as you pointed out, these are not communities ordinarily prone to ecumenical engagement. That may be an understatement.
Exactly. This is also a very interesting part because, as I told you, our fieldwork started in Georgia. And the Georgian Orthodox Church has withdrawn from the World Council of Churches because it does not engage in any ecumenical activity. Now, the Russian Orthodox Church is still a part of the World Council of Churches, but generally the Orthodox grassroots are very anti-ecumenical. They're very suspicious vis-a-vis Western Christians. And there you get occasions of gathering, as I would say these congresses are, where you have interconfessional meetings that are very easy, but of course they proceed without theology. I would say they also proceed without liturgies, for example. So it's a very conference-like setting. It's very business-like also. Yeah. And I would even say that the confessional aspect is played down, because for an Orthodox audience, the foreign origin, sort of the non-Orthodox origin of some of these ideas could be irritating. So it's being played down. And as I said, one thing I also found very striking is that an Orthodox homeschooling curriculum has now been published, and it is a translation of an American curriculum, of the Classical Conversations curriculum. It's been franchised to Russia now. It's been franchised before to Brazil, by the way. It's not the first time that they're translating it. And so now you have a Russian curriculum that is based on a North American model. And also here, if you go to the website, that is not being made apparent, because for a Russian audience, that probably would not be very attractive to make that too apparent.
Well, so now that you are familiar with this, more familiar with this, what do you see in the unusual connections being made?
Well, I think we have to see that in the bigger context of the transition of Europe, especially of post-communist Europe after the end of communism. So, of course, we had a situation of societies that were in a situation of transition and reorientation on all aspects, economically, socially, politically. And sort of social values and questions of coherence and what defines us as a society and also what defines a family were kind of up to negotiation. And I think that many people in the West, they kind of too quickly assumed that the attractive ideas were democracy and liberty and individual human rights. But this is not what has happened. I think also ideas of community are obviously of a great attraction, of democracy, but in a very grounded way, sort of democracy, I'm saying a majoritarian democracy, saying we can discriminate who we want, not a liberal idea of democracy that has guarantees for minorities. And what these connections do, in a way, they provide a language for that. Mm-hmm. They provide a language that warns interlocutors in the East, in Eastern Europe, who are ready to listen, against what they call the ills of liberal democracy. Mm-hmm. They very clearly say that. They alert them to another side of being modern, namely being modern conservatives that use the language of human rights. They are a complete worldview that is exclusionary, hierarchical, in many ways patriarchal, and complete. So I think that's the other thing.
Yeah.
It's in itself. It's a complete and a coherent worldview that is made attractive, and Europe, and as I said, the EU, they were too optimistic, thinking that what the EU represents was the only thing and was the only thing attractive.
As well as you know the communities that we're talking about, how important is it that the foreign sources of this movement remain unknown?
Well, I wouldn't even say that they are hiding them that much. I mean, it's not that I'm not an investigative journalist. I do qualitative interviews as a sociologist, and people talk to me, and I only do research on published sources or websites, and you find that information. So it's not that the information is completely hidden. But of course, there's also a language barrier. I mean, we have the passage from English to Russian, and this passage, in a way, is also mediated by the people who I call norm entrepreneurs who do that mediation. I give you just two examples from my research on Russia. So the Russian homeschooling curriculum, which is called Classical Conversations Russia, Klassicheskie Besedy in Russian, it does not have an official blessing of the Russian Orthodox Church. And the Russian Orthodox Church issued a statement saying that this was not an official project of the Patriarchate. They said that. Another example from the research on Russia is a year ago, the Moscow Patriarchate issued a statement on the question of domestic violence, it was all around a controversy whether the laws against domestic violence in Russia should be tightened. The church was against that. And it was against that because they said domestic violence is a language that destroys the family. Now, this is a trope that comes straight out of a Christian right discourse. It's a language that we find all across countries and churches that are very conservative and anti-liberal. And the document quoted a Western, an American source. So it's not that, so someone who went to see the footnotes would have realized the source. And this was in a Russian text. So again, as I said, it's not that this is so hidden. To some extent, it's quite obvious. But of course, you have to be interested in it to see it.
Yeah.
You know, in Russia, there is a law against foreign agents. So groups that receive financing from abroad have to be registered with the Russian government as foreign agents. And this is widely interpreted as a law to curtail liberal civil society. And organizations like Open Society Institute or the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung from Germany, they have fallen victim of that law. But here we, of course, do have organizations from the West that have relations with organizations in Russia. But for some reason, they don't seem to fall under that close observance that law has afforded.
Hmm. Christina, what's possible in terms of networking and collaboration among cultural conservatives around homeschooling that might otherwise might not be going on?
But I think there are concrete goals they have. I mean, for example, they have a concrete goal that the European Court of Human Rights will express itself in favor of homeschooling. Germany is one of the few countries where homeschooling is completely forbidden. And the American association law firm, Alliance Defending Freedom, has brought a case of a German homeschooling family to the Court of Strasbourg, hoping that Strasbourg would condemn Germany for a violation of human rights because it has a law that prohibits homeschooling. Strasbourg did not do that, but that was the aim. So it was a clear legal strategy. So these are, the immediate goals. The wider implication of this, I think, is that a whole debate on human rights and what they mean is altered. Mm-hmm. So to which areas do human rights extend? Do they extend into the family? Do they extend to non-discrimination on the basis of gender in all respects when it comes to family law, to adoption, and so on? So I think what's happening here is that languages, the language of human rights or human rights as such should again be restricted. It's a, that is a political strategy. And it can be built around many issues. It can be built around homeschooling. It can be built around questions of abortion. It can be built around questions of domestic violence, children's rights. I mean, religious freedom, it can be built around many things. So it's very much a question of who has the right to define human rights.
Yeah. Can you talk about how appealing this movement seems to be to diverse people in different countries and why you think that is? What void is being filled by this?
We still have to see this in the optic of a post-communist transition. I'm speaking about Europe now, and about the expansion of the European Union to countries in Eastern and Central Europe. For the countries in Central and Eastern Europe, EU accession in many ways was a very desired step, but it has also meant giving up legal sovereignty. They're now part of a larger political union. And political parties on the right in all these countries have resented this step, and they are now rather anti-EU in their attitude. Mm-hmm. The counter model to the EU in this moment is Russia, which is the country that is that of strong national sovereignty, non-interference, an aggressive also military defense of territorial non-interference, and even it's expensive. I mean, it's waging a war in Ukraine, and it has the annexation of Crimea. So Russia has affirmed itself as a very strong player in the region against the EU. So I think, in a way, what we have, at least in Europe, is really it's two visions of politics. One, a politics of liberal democracy, and a politics of what the Hungarian Orban government calls sovereign democracy. So, and I think it's these two systems in a way that are being confronted. And the Christian right in the U.S. I think there's one thing which I find always very important. In the United States, you have had a conflict between progressive and conservative groups inside the country for decades. And it's happening it's happening within one polity that has a constitution, that has functioning institutions, and that has elections. And it has institutions that keep the whole thing together. But once this plays out globally, there is no global system that keeps it all together. So this really develops very divisive dynamics between countries.
What do you say to your colleagues about what you're finding in this whole discovery?
First of all, we have to rethink the conservative turn inside Russia. again, I said, I'm a scholar of Russian studies, and I also speak to the Russian community. And there's a tendency to think about the traditional turn or the conservative turn that Russia has taken under Vladimir Putin in the last 10 years as something genuinely Russian, as Russia finding back to its roots. I think this has to be completely revisited, because the Russian conservative turn is embedded in the transnational phenomenon of a globalizing culture wars. That's the first point. And the second point is that we have to become accustomed to the religious landscape globally readjusting. And we are no longer dealing with sort of the main conflicts are no longer between the confessions. They are inside the confessions, between conservative groups and progressive groups. And conservatives across confessions relate in type of conservative ecumenism, and the divisions inside the churches grow. That's true for the Orthodox Church, and it's also true for the Catholic Church, which are the sort of the two universes I observe most.
So do people who are buying into this and using this for their own purposes, how do they see religion and politics? Do they divide it? Do they put them together? How do they come at this?
They see religion and politics as very much related, because they interpret religion in terms of culture, of national culture, or ethnic culture. So if you look at the groups that join these transnational conservative movements in Europe and in Russia, these are groups on the political right. In Western Europe, they tend to be very anti-Islamic, anti-Muslim migration. So they say we have to defend Christian Europe and we have to go back to sort of our Christian values, which are the ones of the family. And, you know, even better, defend them as homeschoolers. So this is one motive, a very close sort of Christian national identity. And in the Russian case, it's the same. Sort of Russia as an Orthodox country that is different from the West.
Christina, what do you consider to be the most dangerous features of this movement, both in any particular place and across the globe?
Well, you know, generally, I think that polarization is dangerous for societies. A very deep polarization on values and on politics. And it's polarization is something that's very difficult to overcome. And you have to mobilize, every community has to mobilize its own resources to overcome polarization by drawing on its own narratives, on its own experiences, and on something that is shared in that community. So I think the danger of a transnational global agenda of anti-liberalism, but even of pro-liberalism, is that communities no longer talk to each other on their own issues and on their own questions, but they launch out at each other with arguments that are kind of copy-paste from different contexts. And so they no longer understand each other. And again, I want to give the example of domestic violence. I mean, domestic violence is a problem in each and every society, but it's a huge problem in Russia. And it's no use speaking about domestic violence in the Russian context, saying, well, this is an attack on the family, because as we see in the human rights language in the UN, that's how it's used. It's no use. It will only lead to people no longer understanding each other. And I think this is really the most dangerous. It's a conversation stopper in democratic contexts.
You are right into understanding what's happening here. What's going to happen as you see it? Is this going to prosper and be very difficult, or is it going to fade away? What's going to happen?
No, I'm not optimistic. I think we are just seeing the beginning of it. I think we are going to see more polarization around many more issues. So in that sense, I think it's good to do research on this, to draw people's attention to it. And that's my task as a researcher. But at the point I stand, where I stand right now, I'm not so optimistic that there will be a way out of polarization soon.
Hmm. Dr. Christina Strukel is professor of sociology at the University of Innsbruck. She is currently principal investigator of the European Research Council-funded research project, POSEC, Post-Secular Conflicts. We reached Dr. Strukel in Innsbruck, Austria. Christina, I can't tell you how grateful we are for you coming to us with this important work, your understanding of it, and for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.